Hey guys, Jeff here from besttechie.com, and this is Techie Bites episode 18. Today I'm speaking with Bill Masters, the original father of 3D printing. We discuss the origins of 3D printing, the current and future state of 3D printing, and being a lifelong entrepreneur. Enjoy. This podcast is supported by Wix.com. With Wix, you can create your own professional website. Choose a template you love or start from scratch, drag and drop to customize anything, and use advanced design features like video backgrounds and image galleries. You can even add professional business solutions like an online store, booking system, or blog. I've personally tested and reviewed Wix on Best Techie and can say without a doubt that Wix is extremely easy to use and a great choice for both novice and advanced users. So go ahead, try it yourself. Go to Wix.com and create your own website today. That's Wix, W-I-X.com. I'm here with Bill Masters, the original father of 3D printing. He also is an entrepreneur, and he started a kayak company called Perception Kayaks, which was the, at the time when he was working on it, the largest kayak manufacturer in the world, pretty much, in the United States at the very least. So welcome, Bill. Thanks for being on the podcast. I appreciate you being here.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for asking.
Thank you for coming on. So I'd love for you to kind of tell, you know, everyone a little bit about who you are, what you've been doing, you know, what you've done, and how long, I guess, you've been doing what you're doing, which is you've really, you know, to encompass everything you've done, you've essentially just been an entrepreneur who's went out and started at least, you know, two companies, perhaps more. I could be wrong. You know, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I grew up in South Carolina. Went to Clemson University, got a degree in electrical engineering, worked my way all through college while I was going to college, and started a kayak company while I was in college because I like to sometimes refer to myself as a controlled adrenaline junkie. And kayaking fulfilled that need. I also enjoy building things, so I built my own kayaks. Unfortunately, broke easy, the earlier ones in fiberglass, so we started developing much more robust fiberglass, our composite kayaks. Did a lot of innovations in there. Built the first Kevlar kayak ever made out of a material called Kevlar. And then discovered a process called rotational molding. Designed and built all the machines for that. And then it took off. That's what revolutionized the industry and made kayaking accessible to the masses.
So you said you built a Kevlar kayak. Does that mean it was essentially like bulletproof? It was like a bulletproof vest.
Well, Kevlar is bulletproof, but Kevlar is actually a fiber that is used in composites. And the original kayaks were composite's the bigger category. Fiberglass, meaning one of the things you can laminate together. Fiberglass, you can do nylon fabrics. There's other fabrics now, but Kevlar was one of the very first.
Gotcha.
And it was made, Kevlar was actually spun in South Carolina as a beginning material, and then it was woven in Anderson, South Carolina, which was 30 miles from our house. So we're kind of in the hotbed of textiles, and back in the 60s, of course, Greenville, South Carolina was the textile center of the world.
Right. So you got into kayaking, because of your interest or your need to kind of have that adrenaline rush, and as you mentioned, in a controlled environment, which is, I guess, depending on what kind of water you're in, it maybe it's not as controlled as in some instances. But what led you to, you know, what led you aside from that? What other things interested you in kayaking?
Well, kayaking, nobody has to get hurt. It's you, the water, and your skills, and your mental. Kayaking is a very mental game. And, of course, I'm a whitewater kayaker. I made kayaks for flat water people, but that's quite boring. And I can give you great stories about ocean kayakers and whitewater kayakers and the mentality, the psychographics of each. They're very different people, but they both take very, very serious risk. One's controlled, meaning an ocean kayaker. The other, whitewater kayakers, we just go out and jump in the middle of it and run.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I've done a couple of different kayaking adventures. One in Grand Cayman with my girlfriend several years ago, and then one out on a lake, which I guess is still water, which is pretty boring, I guess, for you. But we did one of those two person kayaks, and we were just really terrible at it. I just think we weren't in sync when it came to the way we paddled. So I ended up doing most of the paddling. and at one point in Grand Cayman, I was just so tired because we were out on the ocean and they took us around in different places, like different parts, like near shore pretty much. But they ended up tugging, they tied a rope to one end of our kayak, and they just, when the tour guy was just pulling us along. It was a nice rest, but it was kind of embarrassing because everyone else was so far ahead of us.
I can go into detail about kayak, but I don't think that's what we're doing today. But kayaking, if you're kayaking correctly, you're using your middle torso and you're using the inside thighs of your legs. Your arms are just extenders. And if you're not correctly kayaking or bracing, then it gets really tiring quick.
You can say that again. I guess I was doing it way wrong. So one of the interesting things about you is that people may not know this, but you are technically the father of 3D printing, in the sense that you I believe, and I think I have the date right here, but you filed a patent in July 1984.
Yes.
For a 3D printing kind of manufacturing process.
Yes.
I'd love you to tell everyone, and just how did that patent come to be? Like, was this related to your work in kayaks, or was it completely separate?
It was a kayak trip, and it was right after I graduated from Clemson. I was a late bloomer. I when I came out of high school, I worked a couple of years and got married. Mm-hmm. And then I went from there to Clemson University, worked my way through Clemson, and got the degree in electrical engineering. But at the time, I started kayaking, and at that era, most of our kayaking was on Chattooga River, which is a wild and scenic river, which is the border between Georgia and South Carolina, which is a Class 5 river, a serious river. And so we always camped literally right on the side of the river on Highway 76 Bridge. And
so basically that's a river that I should never enter in my current kayaking state.
You should go with a raft company.
Okay.
So anyhow, long story short is one night, you know, you're all sitting around drinking beer. I'm 26 years old. I've been out of school for a year and a half or so. And it was like, well, you know, why can't you make things, you know, in space? Because at the time, the space program was big. And, of course, I came up in that era where, you know, you were a space guy and all that. Mm-hmm. So I was in my sleeping bag. We slept right on the ground at the time. Look up, and there's the stars. And I said, well, why can't you stick those stars together? And so anyhow, that basically was, that's what started the whole thing. So I'm sleeping. We just had that conversation. You know, it was an era of space travel. We just, you know, had to go to the moon. And so I looked up at the stars and I went, why can't you just stick those stars together? But the key to it is you got to have a seed point. You got to have somewhere to start. Tip of your finger, so to speak, the tip of a pen. And if you stick the first one there, you can shoot stars and stick them together and you can make a object. And then I use the analogy of spitballs. If I was standing, you know, what you do when you're 11, 12 years old, you chew up paper and throw it and stick it to the wall. Now, I never did that, but I know other people who might have done that. But
of course,
if you were standing on a balcony and you could throw the first spitball and you stick it on a point, then you could start throwing spitballs around that and stick them. You could make an object. And that was the genesis of the patent. Now, that was 76. I still had long hair, drove a Volkswagen van, and was broke. And so then I was telling my patent attorney, we got to be friends, and I filed a lot of patents in the kayak world. And I told Court one day, and Court used to work at the patent office, I said, here's this idea of sticking spitballs together and make an object. And Court said, let me do research next time I'm in D.C. And he came back and he said, there is nothing on the books like this. So that was probably 1980 that Court did the first, you know, research on it. And then I finally got enough money in, you know, 83, 84 to file the patent. So it actually started in 76 and then it finished up then.
Right. So I think a key thing there is, you know, the fact you were determined to kind of see this through, right?
That's correct. Then I filed that patent, and then I actually I kept trying to raise the money, but the kayak company was growing very quickly at the time.
Oh, so you were doing both companies at the same time. You were trying to juggle the two.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, the kayak company, I always had a research division of the kayak company. The kayak company had its own R&D division that did research for kayaks. That's how we were able to make the best kayaks in the world. We were constantly coming out with new materials and new methods. And gotcha. In that research division, I did other things. I did a graphics process in there when I sold a company that was worth more than the entire company, and they threw it in the trash and sent all the research to the dumpsters. When the VCs bought my company. Yeah, the research we did was pretty phenomenal. But that's what I do, and that's what I had enjoyed doing, and so I used a percentage of my profits in the company to always do research in other fields.
Gotcha.
3D printing happened to be one of them, and that was in the early 90s, and then we raised the first money through Palmetto Seed Capital in South Carolina, which is the venture capital part of South Carolina, through Governor Campbell, and that was the first $200,000. Then there was $15 million raised on top of that. And in the middle of that, I lost control of the patents through just legal wrangling through venture capitalists.
Right.
But as one of the stockholders told me, said, shut up, sit down. You just increased your net worth $4 million. And I went, okay, well, maybe I need to pay attention to the kayak company. Then I had a mentor, which is a really smart guy. And Bob told me, he said, you know, he said, look at it two ways. Put all your eggs in one basket and you watch that basket, or put a few eggs in a bunch of baskets and just expect one or two of those baskets are going to get stolen. So I took the advice and I put all my eggs in the kayak basket and I watched that basket, you know, and that's what made my wealth. Because when I cashed out, I cashed out it more than anybody's ever cashed out in the kayak industry.
Gotcha. That's awesome.
Yeah, so it was a great lesson, and it's a great lesson for entrepreneurs. Is, you know, if you got a good thing, pay attention to it. Don't spread yourself out, and don't let anybody else get into that basket.
It's actually funny that you kind of bring that up, that we're having this conversation today. I don't know if you follow Twitter at all, if you follow Elon Musk's kind of Twitter feed or ramblings on Twitter. But basically, you know, he's a guy who's hugely successful. He's a smart guy, built a number of different companies, and it has his hand in a lot of different kind of pots. And yesterday he was complaining about some coverage he's gotten on different news sites about his Tesla cars. And long story short, he said, I want to start a site where people can rate the reputation of like articles, journalists, sites and stuff like that. And my first response to that was like, dude, you're spreading yourself way a little too thin, don't you think? And I do think that, you know, one of the most important things entrepreneurs can do is have to be successful is to focus on their key business. and not spread themselves too thin, because that's when you get into trouble.
Well, that's what you run into is you got like Musk and myself. We're visionaries.
Right.
And when you're a visionary, you can see you see so many things, and it's a curse. So it's all a choice. Well, we can do it this way, or we can do it better that way. Mm-hmm. And we tend to go off and chase things. I was just lucky that the kayak company was growing. My God, at that point that I started 3D, actually it was called Perception Systems, the kayak company was doubling every 2 years, 2.5 years. That's phenomenal growth.
Hang on
to that. Yeah, and so it's real easy to stand back and realize that at that kind of growth, you're losing your culture, and you got to start paying attention to the culture. Then when that mentor of mine said, you know, all eggs in one basket or a bunch of baskets, it became obvious I had to pay attention to that one basket. And it, like I said, it paid off well. But that's a lesson to all entrepreneurs. It's easy. You start thinking you got the golden touch, and if you do one thing, you're going to do it another. And until they start making money, you really haven't done anything. Musk is an example. He cashed out with a big amount of money. He's funded all these things, but other people's funding them also.
Right.
When I sold my company, I got into several things. I've made a little money on a few, but as a friend of mine that runs a big chain of gas stations here locally, he said, everybody looks at me as like a really smart entrepreneur. He said, they don't see the other 30 companies that fail for every one that makes it.
Right. No, absolutely true. So I want to get back to 3D printing a little bit and talk about, when I was on your website on BillMasters3D.com, I saw that the very first thing you 3D printed, now I could be wrong, but it looked like a rocket ship, or was it a kayak?
the first thing I printed was actually a rotary pen.
Oh, okay.
Yep, and I walked in, and I had a great engineer work for me, and Bob was brilliant. He had his master's in mechanical engineering, and at the time, the computers were just starting to make things happen, and there was a thing called MasterCAM, which is a CAM program. And then there was a thing, AutoCAD. And I'm sure you've heard of PageMaker or Adobe. Well, AutoCAD was the early CAD program. MasterCAM was the program that took the CAD program, meaning AutoCAD, or SolidWorks now is another one. There's a bunch of them now. But it turned it into machine code that made especially a three-axis milling machine, go X, Y, Z. And make a part. And that's called subtractive manufacturing, where you mill something away. Well, I didn't realize it, but when I walked in, Bob says, hey, I got the first part. You know, we're making just surfaces. He says, you got anything you want to make? And I pull my rotary pen off of my lapel of my jacket, and I said, yeah, Bob, make this. And about 2 hours later, he walks into my office, and he said, here, boss. And I just like fell out of my chair. I was like, how did you do that, Bob? And he was just so proud of himself. Well, clip art. You know what clip art is? Well,
yeah.
In the MasterCAM, they had a clip art of a gear. And that was the gear that could be made on a milling machine. Well, Bob just grabbed that clip art of a gear, which is exactly what a rotary pen is, put it into the machine code, spit drops, he had it working really well, and made the first part rotary pen. Little do people know that was the first part ever made, shoot drops make parts in 3D printing.
Wow. That's really
and
cool.
There's about six, there's about six ways to do 3D printing. And then there's some pseudo ways that people say are 3D printing, which really aren't.
Okay. Fill us in a little bit on a couple of those ways.
Well, as an example, mine, shoot drops make parts, is a pure 3D printing. You know, it's taking a computer CAD file, and it's taking something and shooting something out, additive. It's an additive process, but it's doing it robotically to make a 3D part. Okay, Scott Crump at Stratasys. We knew each other. We used to argue as to, Scott, I had the first patent on extrusion, which is like cake decorating. Cake decorating, you can squirt out stuff, and you can go around and around in a circle, and you can make a part. that's what most of these little cheap Autobots and MakerBots are doing. They use extrusion process. Then there's patents who people say are a patent is where you reach and get a brick and you stack a brick on a stack. Well, that's not 3D printing. That's assembly. That's robotic assembly. And so right. The line's being blurred between pure 3D printing, where you design something and then you can make it, versus taking a robot and stacking, like stacking brick. There's an earlier patent on stacking, basically stacking brick, that someone's claiming, okay, this could be 3D printing. It's not. And so I think the industry right now is kind of coming to grips with what is 3D printing. And just like in the early days of airplanes or anything else, it's you know, who gets the news out there and what the definition of it is and what's the purest definition of it.
Right. So I actually I have an interesting story you might like, actually. So I was at a conference in Seattle, I want to say in 2009. And there was a guy who was there at the conference. His name was Bree Pettis. I'm sure you're familiar with that name. And
say that name again.
Bree Pettis, the founder. He was the founder of MakerBot. He was a teacher.
Yeah.
So I was at this conference and he was there, and he had really kind of just started working on MakerBot a bit, and he brought, I guess, one of the early MakerBots to this conference and was printing, 3D printing different things for people at the conference. And it was the first time I had seen a 3D printer in person. And I thought it was the coolest thing. Actually MakerBot is based here in Brooklyn where I'm based. I've been to their headquarters a couple times, and they were also a couple years ago they were bought by Stratasys, actually. And I'm just curious, you know, in you didn't find much success in 3D printing, in the 3D printing space. You obviously were much more successful in the kayaking space, but, you know, utilizing your 3D printing technologies that you kind of researched. From an actual kind of, you know, development of, you know, like a, developing a printer and selling it and things like that, you know, that wasn't really where your success was. What do you think these guys did, especially the MakerBots who were trying, you know, who recently have had their own issues, I guess. But, you know, for a period of, like, I would say 10 years or so, there was a huge push for mainstreaming 3D printers.
Yeah, that's pretty easy. Now you've heard the joke, the first mouse doesn't get the cheese, the second one does.
Right, exactly.
Okay, poor first mouse gets into trouble. Well, the reason that MakerBot started is because my patent and Scott Crump's patent at Stratasys expired on extrusion. Mm-hmm. They had almost 20 years of research of other people to look back at and go, okay, well, here's what worked and here's what didn't work. They took that and went, okay, now the patents are free. We can go out and build anything we want. And all they did was miniaturize it. Now, my original extrusion process is I extruded out a UV-cured glue, the same glue they used to fill your teeth. If you went to the dentist and he did a fill in your tooth, and then he says, okay, now close your eyes, or they put this little thing up over your eyes, and it goes, beep, that's UV, and it makes the glue set. Well, that was my first extrusion process. I have models, a whole box of models that where I made the first extrusion process. Well, Scott did the same thing. And now what's happening with these little MakerBots is they just simply heat up a material. It is typically ABS. ABS is a form of plastic. And they heat it up. It's just, you know what these glue guns, like a home glue gun that you just pull the trigger and you glue stuff together with hot melt glue?
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that? Okay. Well, that's all the MakerBot is. It's nothing but a hot melt glue gun that just runs continuously. And it just wrote, the robot keeps the head going around and around and around. And over the last 20 years, my God, the software, the computer speed, the software has increased hundreds of times. So that was an easy product to make that they made on the MakerBot, and he did it right after my patent expired. See, Scott's patent was just within a couple of months of mine. I beat Scott at Stratasys on the extrusion patent. I had several patents in this field, and but they all expired, and when they expired, that's when the industry took off.
Right. That makes sense. So one of the things that, you know, I remember hearing from lots of people in the space, you know, that while 3D printing was kind of taking off and you know, being mainstreamed, if you will, you know, that was that essentially everyone is going to have their own 3D printer at home. They're going to be able to print their own spoons or, you know, glasses or whatever you want, you know, or parts if something breaks, you know, that to date, that really hasn't happened. Do you think 3D printing, you know, has another kind of jolt left in it to kind of, you know, in terms of consumer use? I know from an enterprise level, a lot of companies use 3D printing, obviously. But on a consumer level, do you think that we're going to see, you know, 3D printers coming back and being pushed and marketed more heavily at people?
I think what happened is when we started is we didn't do it as an industry. We didn't do a good job of saying this is what it really is. Now, there's categories that it really is. For instance, if you want to do art, well, then a 3D printer does a great job in art. But if you want to do anything structural, it doesn't do a great job. If you want to do anything as concept, where you look at it, you can touch it three-dimensionally, it's a great job. Then you got a resolution issue. What's the resolution of the printer? In other words, each time you lay down a drop or you lay down an extrusion, you have a line there. And those two parts are being glued together. Those are all breakpoints. It's not a homogeneous material. Unless you take that and use another process like gloss wax to put it in the metal. Now, there are metal processes that do today that are pretty sophisticated. And it is getting sophisticated, but it's an industrial process, not a home process. So home process, you can make nice, rings a kid can wear. You can make a pair of glasses, but they're not going to be glasses you can see through. You might be able to make the frames. There's a lot of things you can make and a lot of things you can't make, but people have in their head that, oh, 3D printer, I can make anything. No, you really can't. And so the industry hasn't sold itself that there are limitations.
Right. So what, when you filed the patent, what were you thinking of use cases? What were you thinking about utilizing the patent for?
Oh, well, the first thing I had was visualizing a battlefield, quite frankly, that you could print the battlefield. I mean, think about it. You could print the battlefield in real time, you know. Now, again, you got to remember, this is 1980. Computers were just starting. I got a degree in electrical engineering in 74, and I was still designing with zeros and ones, literally. And I will say something else too that's kind of important in that era is I was offered a job at National Semiconductor out in California, and I turned it down, because I was a local guy, you know, and I was married at the time, and I had family all around, and so I chose not to leave South Carolina. When I came up with this idea, I mean, I have friends today that would tell me, I always thought you were just smoking too much dope. And therefore there was no way, you know, I couldn't understand it. And they understand it now, but there was nobody in South Carolina that knew how to even talk about it. We had so little technical skills. Now, flip side is today, that's a whole different world out there in South Carolina. We're very advanced now, but in 1980, no way.
Gotcha. That's interesting. That's your answer was not what I had expected at all. So that's really cool. So I want to talk now. You know, you've been an entrepreneur for decades now. You found success in multiple areas. I I'd love for you to kind of provide, some more advice in terms of what are your like top three kind of things that you tell people that you would, tell other entrepreneurs, if they were seeking advice on something from you.
Well, the first thing I tell people is, every entrepreneur is different. We're not all the same. And when you hear my story, you only hear my story. That may fit or may not fit you. And entrepreneurs, so for instance, I'm an inventor. Okay, so I'm a visionary entrepreneur. I'm crappy at running organizations. I was lucky that I had good products and people gravitated toward me that liked to run organizations. Took me a while to figure out that once I got out of the way, the company ran really well. But it also needed me to make sure that things kept out on the leading edge. There are entrepreneurs who are more entrepreneurs, meaning that they're good second in command. Not everybody wants to be that lead dog out there and take the beatings that we sometimes get. So number one is figure out what kind of entrepreneur you are. What are your skill sets? What can you do and what can you not do? And then the second one is it's really hard. It's not easy. I find people that irritate me at times. They just think if they get close to me, I'm going to tell them the secret. And then they won't have to do anything. They'll know the secret. And I go, the secret is number one,
Dirt.
a lot of hard work, a lot of hard hours, and a good portion of luck thrown in there also. And it frustrates, especially some of the younger crowd who have gotten used to having trophies. I can remember times when I couldn't make payroll, and I've put my head in my hands and cried. I mean, literally, it's that hard. And then I think the last thing on entrepreneurialism is, boy, build those people around you. When you find good ones, you're going to build your culture, and culture is incredibly important. And I used to be a little, you could call it arrogant, but you could also call it, the culture I built. I didn't realize I was building it, but it was, if you can make it here a year, you're good. And because if you were a slacker or you didn't do your job, I'd fire you in a heartbeat because I couldn't afford to pay you. And so what happened is we built a culture around people that went, oh, I've been here over a year. I'm really good. Then what happened is people started taking on that mantra, hey, we're the best there is. And they didn't allow anybody slack in the company. And that was one of the things that made the company really roar. And then everybody, all not everybody, but a lot of people enjoyed outthinking me. And so we had this little game going on where, okay, I can do it better. And I'm a thing person, so I build things. So I would challenge the whole industry. That's why the kayak industry, for quite a few years, never had anybody that copied each other. It was my charge to the industry was, don't copy me, beat me. And if you come out with something, I won't copy you, but I'll make a better product. And so that was kind of the culture that came up through the kayaking industry in the early days. And there was a lot of great innovators in the industry. Some that I've gone up against, I just admire to this day as being incredibly smart kayakers. So those are the three things.
Nice. Bill, I couldn't agree with you more. Those are all solid pieces of advice. Having built a company that I started when I was 13, Best Techie, and then continued to build it while in school, and having started an analytics company that didn't work out in the end, but I worked on it for 4 years, could tell you, there are no shortcuts in entrepreneurship. It's a lot of hard work. I
A
agree
lot
with you
harder.
about, yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you wholeheartedly about the company culture aspect as well. Definitely good tips there. Bill Masters, I appreciate you being on. Before I let you go, I'd love to have you sit for the lightning round. So whenever you're ready, you let me know and we'll get started.
Okay, you're looking for one word or some short answers?
Yeah, exactly. Or yes,
Okay.
or whatever you like better. Here we go.
Yeah, far away.
All right, the most important characteristic for an entrepreneur to have is
Integrity.
Mac or PC?
Oh boy, I have a Mac. I don't like the constraint, but I get frustrated with the battle from the grave to the CEO of the ones still alive and the one that's dead. But they're both brilliant.
So you're going with Mac then?
I'm a Mac.
Okay. Best place to go kayaking?
Chattooga River, Section 3. The best.
I had a feeling you were going to say Chattooga River.
The second one is Lake Kayaking, Lake Joe Cassie, northwest corner of South Carolina.
Awesome. All right, so music or movies?
Music.
Nice. And the very last one, this one's a little bit easy. The last book you read?
Snakes in Suits. The absolute reading for a entrepreneur. Snakes in Suits. It's about sociopaths in business.
Who's the author of that book?
Don't know. But it is mandatory reading. Snakes in Suits.
I'll definitely have to check it out.
3% of the population. Yeah, 3% of the population is sociopaths, and they over the last 30 years they have gravitated greatly to business. And watch out, you got to know that personality. They'll take you down.
But I almost rather that they do that than murder people or something. So I guess that's a positive use of their illness, if you will. All right, Bill Masters, if anyone wants to get in contact with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Bill@BillMasters.com.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot, Bill. I really appreciate you being on this episode of the podcast. I look forward to keeping in touch.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thanks for listening to Techie Bites. Stay tuned for more episodes every Tuesday with awesome interviews and conversations about technology and business. If you like what we're doing, please consider supporting the podcast at anchor.fm/besttechie and or by leaving a rating and review on iTunes. Both ways help us greatly and are much appreciated. So thank you. Until next time, we'll see you. And remember, take care of your computers.